This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehiz Wahib in Washington. Here is what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
Medical advice will tell you that you can't lance your own boil because it spreads the infection. The people doing the lancing the boil themselves are trying to jump into the boil and partake of the disease of corruption.
That's University of Johannesburg Professor Ashwan Desai on the difficulties of rooting out corruption within South Africa's ruling African National Congress. Details coming up. Also, the commander of the Libyan National Army, Khalifa Haftar, rejects the ceasefire offered by the government of National Accord. And in Bamako, ECOWAS mediators are still working on an agreement with Mali's military junta to end the crisis. All these and more ahead on African News Tonight. We start with our top story. Libyan National Army Commander Khalifa Haftar has dismissed the ceasefire offer from the Government of National Accord as a marketing stunt. And Libya's High Council of State, an advisory body to the GNA, rejected any dialogue with Haftar, saying the country's political agreement says dialogue can only be between elected bodies. VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shenawi asked William Lawrence, professor of political science at the American University, where Haftar's dismissal of the ceasefire reflects a rift with Aguila Saleh, the speaker of the Eastern Parliament, who has also called for a ceasefire, or because Haftar was sidelined from the process?
Both. There's definitely a rift and Haftar is feeling sidelined, but we don't know the nature and extent of that rift and sidelining yet. Clearly, Parliamentary Speaker Salah broke with Field Marshal Haftar to make the announcement without his blessing. Salah is trying to make peace and Haftar is preferring and preparing to make war. So judging from past experience, Salah is likely to fall in line behind his general whenever fighting breaks out, and both would blame the other side for the violations of the ceasefire. But if the ceasefire holds, despite Haftar's efforts to scuttle it, then the rift will grow. Clearly, Russia and Egypt have had a bad experience with Haftar in recent months, and this is part of what's driving the rift. So at this point, what Haftar does depends in part on what the Russians and the Egyptians convince Haftar to do. So they might be able to convince Haftar to follow Salah's lead or convince Salah to follow Haftar's lead. It's also important to note that Haftar did not say he was against a ceasefire. He said it was a marketing stunt, and in part probably because he was not included. The reason he was not included is he's seen as undependable, and he's pulled out of every deal, every political arrangement, and every ceasefire he's ever been party to in his entire career. And now the domestic and international stakeholders are starting to move away from him. People are beginning to realize that Haftar is a maximalist who never pursues peace. And now that the circumstances are demanding peace, Haftar's approach is becoming more unpopular.
So if Haftar's foreign backers like the United Arab Emirates, which welcomed the ceasefire proposals from both sides, stop their support for him, does this mean that Saleh and Sarraj will be able to come to a peaceful agreement and bring about a lasting peace in Libya?
Yes, and that's increasingly likely even if Haftar drags out this unnecessary war for as long as he can. The UAE is paying for most of his thousands of East African and Syrian mercenaries. They may even be paying for the 1,500 Russian mercenaries of the Wagner Group. They are providing drones, arms, and logistical support. So if all that goes away, Haftar will have to lean harder on Russia and Egypt. But right now, Russia and Egypt are even further from him than the UAE. Of course, there will be a lot of finger pointing at Turkey and Qatar. But it's Haftar that started the war in 2015. It's Haftar that welcomed the huge Russian and Emirati-funded buildup. It was Haftar that attacked Tripoli when the UN General Secretary was there. And it's Haftar that's in the way to peace now. So if Haftar loses his foreign support, Salah will definitely make a deal with the Western government.
Libya's High Council of State, an advisory body to the GNA, rejected any dialogue with Haftar. And in a statement, it said, any dialogue or agreement should be under the Libyan political agreement, which regulated the mechanism of dialogue to be only between elected bodies. Is excluding Haftar feasible when he controls the Eastern forces and militias?
I'll be honest with you. I used to think that excluding Haftar was not feasible at all for the reasons in your question. And now we're seeing that the Libyans want politics to be led by politicians and not by generals. So that the High Council of State wants to deal with its eastern counterpart, the House of Representatives, both of which were created by the 2015 Libya political agreement. And they're right. That's the lane that political negotiations should be in. But the cause of the war was not a breakdown in political discussions between the two houses of parliament. The cause of the war was that General Haftar started a war deliberately in May 2015 with an attack on the parliament, with an attack on democracy. So Friday's ceasefire announcement is welcomed by both houses of parliament, and it wants to put politics back on track. But if Haftar says no, we won't have peace because he is the army. So this is why we have to do exactly what your questions are asking. We have to watch Salah and Haftar's every move. We have to see if Salah will further break from Haftar, marginalizing Haftar, or whether Salah will kowtow to Haftar as he has in the past, and Haftar will be running the show again. Either way, one may try to force out the other. And in the meantime, we need to see who gains the upper hand. But for now, it's clear that Haftar, not being party to any negotiations, won't agree to anything.
That was William Lawrence, professor of political science at the American University, speaking with VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shenawi. In Bamako, ECOWAS mediators are still working an agreement with Mali's military junta to end the crisis. Key talking points include the fate of ousted President Ibrahim Boubacar Keita and the political transition to return power to a civilian government. Nicolas Pinot reports from Paris.
Officials say progress has been made since Saturday and a deal could be announced soon between leaders of the military junta led by Colonel Assimi Goïta and mediators from West Africa's regional bloc led by former Nigerian President Goodluck Jonathan. We have been able to agree on a number of points, but not yet on all the discussions, Jonathan told reporters last night after a second round of negotiation that lasted around 9 hours. Three main points in these discussions. ECOWAS sanctions on Mali as the regional bloc condemned the coup carried out by the military nearly a week ago. The fate of Keita, who was among the officials arrested by the military during the coup. Soldiers seem to be willing to release him and allow him to travel abroad for treatment. Prime Minister Boubou Cisse will be moved to a secure residence in the city. The most heated debate concerns Mali's transition to civilian rule. The junta, known as the National Committee for the Salvation of the People, offered a three-year transition led by a soldier and made up of mostly soldiers. That is seen as too long and too favorable to the soldiers to be accepted. The coup leaders had vowed a quick transition back to civilian rule. West African heads of state are scheduled to hold a video conference this week on Mali based on the outcome of the current mission. Nicolas Pinot for VOA News, Paris.
A prison in northern Uganda has been shut down after three quarters of the inmates tested positive for COVID-19 over the weekend. They have been isolated and quarantined. Catherine Nambi reports.
The inmates and prison staff who tested positive were among the 318 COVID-19 cases that Uganda registered on Saturday, the country's largest one-day total. Dr. Ruth Acheng is Uganda's health minister.
The Ministry of Health undertook further investigations in Amuru prisons. Out of the 205 inmates, 153 inmates tested positive. Out of the 28 prison staff, one tested positive.
These have now been evacuated to Gulu main prison for treatment and quarantine, while the Amuru prison will be sprayed as measure to control further the COVID-19 spread. Frank Baine is Uganda Prisons Service spokesperson.
We have managed to evacuate the sick ones who are asymptomatic, by the way, to Gulu Prison Treatment Center, and we have taken the staff to Guru Referral Hospital. The other ones who didn't test positive remained in Amul, but they are under observation, and we are hoping to have another test carried out to ensure that nobody is sick behind there.
A joint surveillance team from the Ministry of Health and Center for Disease Control are undertaking risk assessment and contact tracing in Amuru District. Baine has called for mass testing of all prisoners and staff to avoid further spread of the virus to other prisons.
So we expect Minister of Health to respond to us and have all these sensitive areas covered by testing everybody. If we are to avoid continuous contamination of the prison's population with COVID, the police must start testing suspects before they bring them to us.
There are concerns, congestion in the prison system, which has 61,867 prisoners and 12,060 staff, could make the avenues for the spread of COVID-19. Earlier this year, President Yoweri Museveni pardoned more than 800 prisoners as part of efforts to reduce that risk. Uganda is currently experiencing a surge in cases of COVID-19. Authorities have blamed lax public attitudes since the country's lockdown was eased and have threatened to reinstate the restrictions. Uganda has registered 2,362 cases with 22 deaths. This is Catherine Nambi for VOA News in Kampala.
South Africa's government is under more pressure to crack down on corruption related to supplies of equipment to protect people against COVID-19 after the chief of the World Health Organization equated it with murder. Law enforcement agencies are investigating scores of companies and individuals linked to the ruling African National Congress, or ANC, for allegedly stealing millions of dollars meant to be used to combat the coronavirus. Darren Taylor reports.
For a quarter century, South Africans have heard promises that senior officials would be jailed for corruption. Scandal after scandal has implicated prominent ruling party members. Yet not a single one is in prison. President Cyril Ramaphosa says this time it'll be different. A man who knows the ANC really well, University of Johannesburg professor Ashwin Desai, is skeptical.
Medical advice will tell you that you can't lance your own boil because it spreads the infection. The people doing the lancing of the boil themselves are trying to jump into the boil and partake of the disease of corruption.
Director of Public Prosecutions, Advocate Shamila Batoi, says her investigators will prioritize certain cases involving PPE fraud because there are too many to probe.
We have limited resources, and so, you know, we certainly won't be able to do all, but we need to send out a very strong message that law enforcement is up to the task and that the wheels of justice are indeed turning.
Again, words and promises that South Africans have heard many times before. Justice Minister Ronald Lamola has now made a new pledge of 12 special courts to prosecute COVID-related crimes.
We understand the urgency of this issue because it is interlinked with what society is looking for, that there must be speedy resolution to these issues if and when they arise.
South Africa's tax chief, Edward Kisweta, says it's not enough for some in the ANC to award themselves multi-million rand tenders to supply medical equipment they never deliver. Their greed is apparently bottomless.
Not declaring income from PPE, even though they get that from government, they still choose to cheat government. They have outstanding tax returns. They file fraudulent or incorrect returns. They obtain tax clearance certificates by fiddling the system, and they're not registered for VAT.
Desai says the ANC's policy of cadre deployment is largely to blame. This unwritten law rewards members with senior state positions not for their skills, but for their loyalty to the party and ability to win votes during elections.
There's a kind of strain and a spine to the ANC that is shameless. And I think until we deal with this idea of cadre deployment, that you're not answerable to the country, you're not answerable to the municipality, but you're answerable to the people who employed you, there's going to be a problem.
The PPE scandals, says Desai, show corruption didn't end when Ramaphosa replaced Jacob Zuma a couple of years ago.
Zuma's faction was defeated at one level and pushed back, and Ramaphosa came to power. But, you know, once again, in order for him to come to power, it wasn't an ideological battle. He had to enter this pit of corruption and pay people to vote for him. So there was never an immaculate conception, right? You sort of get rid of the original sin in Zuma and so on, and you come tainted yourself and carrying that baggage.
It's Desai's view that the PPE fraud offers the ultimate evidence that corruption was never a Zuma problem. It remains a cancer within the ANC that's slowly killing the country. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
Critics worry democracy is under attack in Zimbabwe as arrests of dissidents and opposition figures have continued as part of a crackdown on dissent despite international criticism. Reporter Kuzaza Nwashi has more from Harare.
The latest to be arrested is the main opposition's vice chairman, Job Sikala, who was taken into custody on similar charges to those faced by journalist Opol Chingono and transformed Zimbabwe leader Jacob Ngarevume. They are accused of public violence after they called for people to participate in a planned national protest July 31st that fizzled after the government reimposed COVID-19 restrictions and put a large security presence on these streets. Chingono has been incarcerated for over a month, and the court barred his lawyer, Beatrice Mtetwa, from representing him last week on grounds of alleged professional misconduct. Chingono's bid to get bail have been fruitless, including his latest bid today. Roslyn Hanzi is one of the Zimbabwe Lawyers for Human Rights legal team representing him.
The magistrate who was hearing the fresh bail application that had been filed on behalf of Opol Chingono, based on changed circumstances, today dismissed the application. Basically, he said that in his view, what was presented before him did not amount to changed circumstances.
Hanzi says Chingono's lawyer hasn't been able to gain access to her client in prison.
Our lead counsel, who was representing Opol Chingono, being denied audience by the magistrate court last week, and she's now being barred from even consulting with the client, even at prisons. It appears that the members of the Zimbabwe Prisons and Correctional Services are now interpreting that lack of audience in court to also apply to other places of detention and other facilities.
The international community has spoken against Zimbabwe's crackdown on dissent, with neighboring South Africa sending envoys to investigate the situation. Analyst Rashid Mukund says this has a bearing on government's re-engagement efforts with the international community, including efforts to get sanctions lifted and gain international investment in the tattered economy.
It's unfortunate the time that the government is talking of re-engagement with the international community. It is not willing to listen to the voice of the international community when they are being counseled and being cautioned on the need to end the human rights abuses.
Munyara Zidodo, editor of Open Pali, an online publication that covers political developments and parliament issues, says COVID-19 has been used as an excuse to curtail free expression and other human rights. He adds that the government is sending a message that it will not tolerate dissent. The government has denied that, saying it is only tackling those trying to disrupt it with the help of foreign terrorists. For VOA, this is Kudzai Zunamashe from Harare.
The World Health Organization is concerned by the rapid increase and spread of the deadly Ebola virus in remote, densely forested areas of Equator Province in Western Democratic Republic of Congo. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
Health officials report 100 people in DRC have been infected with Ebola in fewer than 100 days, killing nearly half or 43 of those who have contracted this highly contagious disease. The World Health Organization says the virus is continuing to spread and is already in 11 of the province's 17 health zones. This is of particular concern because of the difficulty of reaching affected communities in the geographically vast area. WHO Director General Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus says there currently is a delay of about 5 days from the onset of symptoms to when an alert about a suspected case is raised.
This is concerning because the longer a patient goes without treatment, the lower their chances of survival, and the longer the virus can spread unseen in communities. The situation has been further complicated by a strike by health workers, which is affecting activities, including vaccination and safe burials.
Healthcare workers in Imbandaka, Ecuador's provincial capital, recently went on strike in protest over allegedly unpaid wages. After promises by the government to investigate, the strike reportedly now has ended. Nevertheless, money remains a central problem in the fight to combat this epidemic disease, especially as COVID-19 resources are draining funds away from Ebola operations. Tedros says the operation is seriously underfunded.
There continues to be an urgent need for increased human resources and logistics capacity to support an effective response across an ever-expanding geographical area and to help health officials identify cases earlier. The government of DRC has developed a plan that needs about $40 million. We urge partners to support this plan.
This latest Ebola outbreak, DRC's 11th, was declared in DR Congo's Equator province on June 1st, just as the previous outbreak in North Kivu and Ituri provinces was winding down. That outbreak, the largest in the country's history, infected 3,481 people and killed nearly 2,300. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
A protest march by trafficked Gambian women seeking help from their consulate in Beirut boiled over and they vandalized the building. Gambia's foreign ministry is appealing for calm and says efforts are underway to help evacuate the women, some of whom said they had escaped from their Arab owners. Reporter Panderambai reports from Raleigh, North Carolina.
With their faces covered, the women said they are tired of living in Lebanon and chanted that they want to go home. They then stormed the perimeter of the consulate and started hitting the doors with hammers that they brought with them. Sekou Cisse is the spokesman for Gambia's foreign ministry. He says his government doesn't condone any form of violent protest.
The Minister of Foreign Affairs condemns this action in absolute terms. We condemned it, and then we also condemn in absolute terms the willful damage to property.
Cisse says none of the protesters was arrested because that would slow the government's efforts to help the stranded women by making emergency passports and raising funds for them.
When the police attempted to arrest them, it was the Honorary Consul himself who intervened and asked them to let them go, because we are, as of now, at an advanced stage to return them to the country.
Cisse reaffirms the government's commitment to fighting human trafficking and said officials would work with authorities in Beirut to investigate the situation. But Gambian political analyst Pasamba Jau says there is a lack of political will to tackle human trafficking. He says massive unemployment is driving Gambian youngsters into making dangerous journeys overseas, and there is little at home to inspire them to stay. For VOA News, this is Panderambai reporting from Raleigh, North Carolina.
And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehiye Suhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Mokbilia Baro, thank you again for tuning in and choosing the Voice of America.
Hey, sports fans, brighten your day by tuning into the sunny side of sports Monday through Friday at 16:30 and 18:30 UTC. Join us on Facebook at facebook.com/VOA Sunny and on Twitter at VOA Sunny Sports. Or check out the blog at blogs.voanews.com/sunny. It's the sunny side of sports right here on the Voice of America.